Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, and this week's show is sponsored by ChristianCafe.com, so make sure that if you have not tried out Christian Cafe and you've thought of making a foray into the world of online dating, that you do go there and get your special deal for boundless folks. So again, ChristianCafe.com. Okay, later on in the show, we have John Thomas with us, and he's going to be talking to a guy who wrote in about maybe not feeling like he is where he should be in his career and really struggling on the job front and wondering if that even makes him marryable or if he needs to wait, or quite frankly, I think he, you know, thinks, you know, without that, he's useless. And so John's going to weigh in on that. And then we have part two this week with Tim Gegline. I know many of you have responded to his the first part of his interview of his time in the White House with President George W. Bush, and then the plagiarism scandal that led to his departure there and what God has taught him in the wake of that. So make sure that you tune in for part two. But on the front end of the show, we have our round table, and I have with me in the studio Martha Krinke. Hey, Martha.
Hi, Lisa.
Hello. We are fresh back from Louisville, Kentucky, where we did a number of show tapings and just took in the charm of the city and the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary campus.
It was a good trip. Yeah.
It was a good trip. And their free coffee.
Oh, we love that. The hotel lobby. My goodness.
Yeah. It like made your own Starbucks. Like it ground the beans right there as you, it was a machine and you just press a button. It was amazing. So it was worth the trip.
And
right
it was there. Cold there.
It so was cold. I was disappointed.
We were surprised.
But. Apparently I'm just geographically stunted in some areas because I thought of Louisville as being in the South and everyone's like, that's not the South, you know? So I was like, why is it cold? And I just apparently expected magnolia trees to be blooming or something. I don't know.
There was green grass.
But there
that
was
nice.
There was green grass. So that was nice. And we heard great speakers, Kevin DeYoung, David Platt, all of whom have been on the show in the past, Dr. Moeller and Dr. Russell Moore. And so you'll be hearing from a few of them again as we talk to them. So Jen Scheck is in the room. She's a good friend of mine here at Focus on the Family. Jen, welcome.
Hi, thanks, Lisa.
She's also been featured on past shows. What was that? Like one related to dating, online dating.
Right.
Yeah.
And then we talked about Harry Potter last time.
Oh, right. Jen, you're just a girl of all trades.
Yeah, I guess so.
So she is here. We are actually going to be talking about singles adopting, and that is part of Jen's story. So she is here to weigh in with her own experience and kind of her hopes and dreams in that direction. And also on the phone with us, we're so glad that she's able to pipe in here, is Diane Zapponi. Diane, welcome.
Hi.
Great to have you. She's calling in from Arizona, and she's a contact that we got through our Wait No More folks here at Focus on the Family, and they have talked with her. She works at a radio station down there, so great to have you as part of the conversation, Diane.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Well, hey, I want to just start by talking about how really the whole reason we're discussing this is because I think the topic of singles adopting has become much more prevalent in the last decade, especially, and certainly at Focus, it is on our radar since we started our Wait No More initiative. And I can't even tell you how many people I know that work here or that live in Colorado Springs that are now adoptive parents. I mean, it is like, it's the thing to do, isn't it, Jen?
Just in general, yeah. it is.
It is. It's just amazing, you know, and you'll see, you know, all the little families with the international adoptions and they're just so like running around their little cornucopia of folks. And that's really fun. And then, but we're going to talk specifically about singles adopting because we've actually received some questions related to that and just kind of wondering what Focus's or Boundless's take is on that. Is it biblical? What does this look like practically? Is it something that is possible? And so I want you to ladies, Jen, maybe you can start just by talking about how the idea of this and even the possibility of it came onto your radar and you really started seeing it as something that God might be leading you toward.
Yeah, I want to context it with I've always kind of had a heart for adoption and always kind of considered it in the context of marriage, actually. And over the last probably year and a half, just doors have opened for me and God has just kind of prompted my heart to look into it. And so it's definitely been a journey. And I started out, you know, really very wide scope and just kind of felt like the Lord was saying to me, this is the way, just walk in it. And so as I have gone through, I've met different people. And, you know, number one, I took it before the Lord. I took it to people who I trusted, who knew me, who knew my situation, who knew my support system, who were a part of my support system, people who would be willing to stand next to me, and really had to be open to whatever the Lord said in that. So, but it's been quite a journey.
Yeah, definitely. And would you say, I mean, was there something that specifically triggered this as I'm still single, but this is now going to be a possibility for me and I'm going to move into looking towards this?
Yeah, you know, I think there's the spiritual side of wanting to follow in the Lord's footsteps, but then there's a practical side of me that says I'm getting to an age where I'm going to get really tired a lot faster and I'm not going to have the energy to be a mother and the things that I've wanted to do. And, you know, it's always been in my heart to be a mother and a wife. Mm-hmm. I still have those dreams in my heart. I still have those visions. This just was a way to walk a path and see if that's what the Lord had for me. And, you know, I didn't want to be too tired to do it.
Right.
quite practically.
Because you're now in your 30s. You're just
right.
Ancient.
Mid-30s.
I love how when women talk about that, we're just like, so anyway, I'm just getting older and tired and oh dear. Yeah. You're young girl. Mm-hmm. So Dan, what about you?
Well, first of all, I am ageless.
All right.
I've actually formed the Ageless Club, and if they all want to join it, you're welcome to join it, because I'm not going to obsess over age anymore. And so I just thought I'd throw that out there. Mm-hmm. But in terms of adoption, I was working for an agency. I went to work for an agency in Phoenix back in 2005. And I came there as a VP of marketing and community relations and development and PR and 300 other hats, as you do when you work for a ministry. And a couple months into it, and I had met a lot of children because this was a child social services agency, Christian-based, and I'd met, you know, several children along the way. But I too, though, had adoption in the back of my mind, but I figured the Lord would bring the husband first and then the child, because that's kind of how things are done, except for in my life, a lot of things are kind of done funny, but I still see God's hand in it. And so I met this little child who came in as a foster child. She was about 3 or 4 months old, and she was with another family, actually, that had worked at the agency. And the funny thing is that I was allowed to get to know this child a little bit more because I had dark hair, and everybody in her family had light-colored hair. So this is kind of a funny reason, but and the birth mother had dark hair, so the foster mom wanted Emmy to be comfortable with somebody with dark hair because she had to go on these visits every week. So that was kind of how I got to know her initially, but have just kind of grew to love her and never really was sure about, you know, what was going to happen with her case, because in foster care it's a absolute emotional roller coaster ride and you don't know what's going to happen. But I started praying about it all, and you know, that, you know, if this child would become available, is this something that I should do as a single parent? I mean, that was my first question. Should I even do this? And so I started praying about it. And then I thought, well, I'm going to go get licensed, because that way at least I can take her for overnights and weekends, and I'll be all state approved and, you know, go by the book here. And, you know, that's kind of gradually how I moved into it. And then there came a point where they severed the parental rights for the birth mother. They didn't know who the dad was. And they started identifying who might be a parent for her. And since I had a relationship with her, they made a recommendation that I could be that person, and the courts reviewed my case, and they said, well, if you're interested in doing this, you know, yes, we would allow this. And so I, you know, got certified so that I was ready and in place should this go through. And so she came to live with me full-time at about a year and a half. You know, fortunately for me, we had a long transition, so when she finally came to live with me full-time, it wasn't a big deal for Emmy. It wasn't traumatic for her. So, and she's been the most amazing blessing. But I, you know, I just want to say too that it has not been a cakewalk in terms of being a single parent. It is exhausting.
Well, and I was actually going to ask both of you, you know, what really were, obviously there were people, I'm sure, that came into your lives that were like, are you sure about this? Does this really, I mean, are you just making an emotional decision? Is this something that, you know, maybe if you try this instead? I mean, what was the response of the naysayers, would you say?
Well, for me, I mean, I'm in a child social services agency, and so I really prayed a lot about this, and I spoke with the executive director there and several of the therapists there. We fortunately had the largest attachment therapy department in the state, so I had a lot of resources around me to talk to them and counsel with them about whether this was a good thing to do or not. Could I do it? We had an amazing bond, which I believe was the Lord, because this little girl really wouldn't bond with anyone, but she did with me immediately. And, again, I kind of just see God's hand in that. But I just wanted to make sure I was doing it for the right reasons, too, because I wanted to be the best mom if I could be. I wanted to be the best family for her. And so, I looked at my own family. I looked at my little village around me, my friends. And, I mean, I had so much support to go ahead and move forward with this that, I just saw that as God's hand. But I really had to struggle back and forth. And I finally got to a place where I just said, okay, Lord, I'm going to move forward with this. If you don't want this, you close the door. And that's kind of how I had to put it to him, because otherwise you just go back and forth, back and forth. And I also felt like if I were asking other people to be fostered, consider fostering an adoption, and I wasn't willing to do it, how can I ask somebody else to do it if I'm not? But I know that the challenges of being a single person, but you have to have a network, because you cannot do this all by yourself. You have to have family or close friends who are willing to help you with the various things that you're just going to need, and backup. And you want, as a female, I need to have strong male role models in my daughter's life, too, because I wanted her to see healthy Christian men. And so, you have to take all those things into consideration. It's not like, you just have this little plaything. I mean, this is a human being, and you want to make sure that you have all those things in place. And the bottom line for me is that it was about personal obedience to the Lord. And is this what the Lord is calling me to do? And I felt that it was. And it wasn't because I was seeking it out. I wasn't. This came out of nowhere for me.
Yeah. Jen, what kind of opposition did you hear about?
I agree with Diane on a lot that she said. Really, the blessing to me is I've given it time. I've given it prayer. And the people that I talked to who knew me and know me well and were willing to say the hard things and ask me the difficult questions. So I don't know that I had a lot of naysayers. I would say the harshest thing someone said to me was, well, what are you going to do about work? And obviously the situation is that I have to work. I have to provide for my mm-hmm. family. And so it's not, as Diane said, it's not a cakewalk. I mean, you have to really think it through, and you definitely have to have a support system around you. And it's not like easy insta family, like, oh, in 6 months I'm going to have a child in my home. There is a lot of pain in the process. There's a lot of indecision and questioning that goes through your mind and you have to deal with. And I think it's not just a simple solution because you want to be a mom. I think that you really have to have been, as Diane said, led into it mm-hmm. and really trusting the Lord and surrounding yourself with people who are going to support you.
Yeah. Well, and like you said, even getting to adoption can be an emotional roller coaster.
Oh, yeah.
And Jen, why don't you tell a little bit of your story of kind of where you've come in this process? Because I know you're pretty raw and fresh mm-hmm. off of a disappointing experience.
Yeah, I walked through a lot of different doors that led me to a wonderful agency of lawyers who set me up twice now for adoption, and both times that has failed, not because of anything to do with singleness. The first time had to do with a circumstance way outside of my control. And then just recently, about 3 weeks ago, I had worked with a birth mom for 6 months. I saw her on a Friday. She was ready to give birth. She told me not to worry. We had bonded. We'd had a really good connection. I'd met her kids. I'd spent a lot of time with her. And then on Monday, she went into the hospital, refused to talk to anyone. I haven't heard from her since. Basically, the adoption failed. So there's just a lot of, you're not walking into like the solution to wanting to be a mom.
mm-hmm, yeah.
There's a lot more to the situation than, and you really have to be trusting the Lord, and in every step he's been so faithful to me and surrounded me in his love, but also with just the love of that same support system that is committed to help me when I am placed with the right child.
Yeah. It's almost like what Diane said about how you just have to trust that God's going to shut doors that aren't meant for
right.
you. And it's hard when for you now it's happened twice.
Right.
Diane, what would you say what's been the most difficult adjustment for you? Because you now, your daughter is now 8, right?
She'll be 8 next month. Yes.
So you've had some years under your belt here now.
Yes, but Jen, my heart goes out to you. It really does. I mean, I just know what it was like in the foster care, up and down, you know, and if relatives are going to come out of the woodwork and all of that. So I just, my heart goes out to you.
Thank you.
In terms of the most difficult, well, I was a freewheeling single. So that was probably the hardest thing, was that you can't do that anymore. So now I'm all about schedules and routine and, you know, and really, I don't mind it at all. I absolutely love this little girl. I could not have picked a better child myself. We're two peas in a pod. She's just absolutely a delight. You know, pretty much, you know, we're humming along now. But she came to me about 2 years ago saying, Mom, I'd like a dad. And I'm like, oh, okay. So, well, do you know anybody?
We better go to the store and get one.
Yeah, right. That's what she said. You know, like, can we go to the daddy store? That's exactly what she said. And I said, well, no, honey, it doesn't quite work like that. And so she started praying about it. But honestly, I was absolutely content in my singleness, which I think is important for anybody to hear this, is that that's where the Lord wants you. And that's the best place you can be, is being content in your singleness and relying completely on the Lord. And but he brought me through enough things that that was the only place I could go, was to the Lord. And so he taught me, rely on me, rely on me, rely on me. I'm going to take care of you. I will provide for you. And he showed me that over and over and over again. And so I was really kind of at a place where I liked it with the Lord and with Emmy and school and work, and everything was humming along. And she, now she wants a dad. I'm like, oh, I don't know about this. But, you know, it took a little while for me to kind of open up to that idea. And in this year, or I should say a year ago, January, I said, well, Lord, if you want to bring somebody out, I'll think about it. That's kind of how I put it. And then through circumstances, a friend of mine who lost his wife 2 years ago to cancer, we kept running into each other at ministry events, and we've known each other for 12 years. And you know, he said to me in April last year, he says, you know, I kind of like you. I think we ought to hang out and see what happens. And I'm like, huh? You know, so I was like, really? And so we've been on this journey, but we're going to be getting married and at the end of April. And it's been a really fun journey to see how God is bringing a family together in a very unique way. And so we're planning to adopt Gary at the end of April.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
That's cute. I remember you you saying that when you originally emailed us, how you were adopting each other.
Yeah.
So that's good. You'll be a little blended family.
Yes,
so.
and it's been quite a journey. In fact, I even said that to Emmy when it was about 3 and a half by the time we finalized her adoption, and I have this on video for her when she gets older too. But I said, you know, I said, do you want me to be your mom? And she said, yes. And then she asked me, she said, do you want me to be your daughter? And I turned the camera around and I said, yes. So that's kind of how we talk about it. We're very open about the adoption to each other and everybody else, because we want to be advocates for adoption. We think it's a great thing, and we know the need is so great. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I just want to encourage anyone who's thinking about it to at least go through the steps, because the Lord will give you the answer even as you're going through the process.
Right. And I know so many people talk about, and obviously it's reality, you know, what is an ideal situation and how do we deal with that? And of course, here at Focus on the Family, we would say that, sure, an ideal situation is a mom and a dad raising a child. But what I think is so exciting about your stories, you and Jen, is that this isn't about just a home and getting a kid out of foster care and putting a roof over a kid's head. This is about putting a child in a home that proclaims the gospel.
Right.
And is, you know, it's about, I mean, this is why we're so passionate at Focus on the Family, about challenging the evangelical church to step up and start taking that biblical mandate seriously to care for orphans and for widows, and recognize that this is really a charge that we have. And I think it's neat, obviously, Diane, you know, your story, you know, you didn't bargain kind of getting another adoptee of a husband into this, but but you were open to it.
Yeah.
And that's good. And like Jen said as well, she's certainly open to it as well. And that would have been her plan A, but it doesn't mean that she doesn't listen to the Lord when he's talking about children in this sense. So would you say, both of you, what would you say if you had to give advice to others who are maybe this just wasn't on their radar, and now all of a sudden they're like, oh my word, or maybe they've been thinking about this and praying about it for a while. What would you say to them in their own experiences?
Well, I would say first, I heard a statistic that the number one group that is becoming more and more impoverished are single moms.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not an easy, quick fix, and you have to know your situation and you have to know your support system. As Diane said, you have to have men in your life who are going to be that role model and example. You have to have other women in your life who mm-hmm. are going to show the love of Christ the way that they live too. And then I would say, go to that person who you know who it is, that is going to tell you the truth, who knows you better than anyone else and is going to be able to evaluate who you are. I mean, obviously you go to the Lord first, but then go to those difficult people who are not going to be afraid and not going to try and make you feel good, and tell them what is on your heart and see what they say. The people that know you and know the Lord will tell you the truth about where you're at and what your situation is.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's so cool. And I just really appreciate both of you joining this conversation and being part of it and really being willing to share from your own stories, the ups and the downs. And for anyone who is interested in finding out more, of course, we've talked much about our Wait No More program here at Focus on the Family. That's just a good way not only to understand, of course, that's primarily about U.S. foster care, but just to understand the heart for orphans that really is necessary and how you can cultivate that and really what's going on in the U.S. and around the world. They are at iCareAboutOrphans.org. So make sure you get the info on that. Thank you, Diane and Jen, for being part of this conversation.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Lisa, for having us.
Well, Tim, you actually start the book. I mean, here we are. We've talked a lot about the president and a lot about just your involvement in the White House and the many things that you got to see. But you actually start the book, and I think it's an interesting way to start the memoir, with a day when you said, you described it as the most beautiful morning, and by evening, probably, you know, what you described as the worst day of your life. Mm-hmm. A day when you decided to open up an email from a reporter who asked you if you had plagiarized a portion of a column that you'd written for a paper in Indiana, in your hometown. And you basically just responded and said, "I did." And then from there, you pretty much knew that a snowball of events would occur, including most likely losing your job. And, you know, I mean, this was all over the papers. It was reported. I mean, really what you said, you know, you hold up for that weekend pretty much.
Yes.
Just to gather yourself and really apologize to your family and just start what would become a series of events of apologizing to a bunch of folks. And I want you to just kind of highlight that a little bit, especially your feelings going into the Oval Office, feeling, I think you described it as feeling like the hammer was going to come down with the president and what he would have to say, and what did he actually say?
Yeah, well, I'm happy to share this. And I want to offer one prelude, which is one of the chapters is called Fortunate Friendships. And one of the fortunate friendships I had over a long period of time was with William F. Buckley. And Bill Buckley and I became very good friends. We became sailing friends.
It's a pretty good account in the book itself of your landlubber experience.
Thank you. He once said to me, and speaking of his time with President Nixon, he said, "It's a remarkable thing to be in the Oval Office with the leader of the free world when you're speaking and you noticed that the leader of the free world is taking notes while you're speaking." And I say that because when I was enjoying this extraordinary, remarkable professional position in my life, in fact, it was the job that I would have done for free if I were a billionaire. I loved my work with George W. Bush. But as I recount, I had gotten a very bad strain of Potomac fever. Mm-hmm. And Potomac fever, for some people, takes the avenue of sex. And some people, it's power, and some people, it's money. With me, it was pride. It was a venal, egotistical pride of wanting to be the clever one, the one who wrote it and said it better than anyone. And so the power of self-deception is very large. And it wasn't pressure or stress. I knew exactly what I was doing. So when I popped open the email And I, as I describe in the book, I literally fell down next to my desk at the White House. And I said, oh God, because I knew it was true. And I said to the reporter, guilty as charged. And I knew that I would resign that day, and I did. And in the political classes, as you know, Lisa, from your time as reporting in Washington, a kind of divorce takes place when you embarrass the president or the senator or the congressman. You are cut off and persona non grata, and usually right away. And when I left the White House that Friday, that's what I expected my fate to be. When I came in on Monday to take the pictures off the walls and began clearing out my desk, the chief of staff said to me the words that nobody in the White House ever wants to hear: the boss wants to see you. And I expected my proverbial woodshed moment, and I deserved it. I brought this crisis on myself. And at no extenuating circumstances, no excuses, I was 100% at fault. And I embarrassed the president and my family and 20 years of interns, and I could go on and on and on. So I expected this woodshed moment. I went into the Oval Office. It was the president and me. And I closed the door, and I turned to him to apologize. And he looked me directly in the eyes, and he said, Tim, you're forgiven. And I was stunned. And I looked at the president directly in the eyes, and I attempted a second time to apologize. And he said, grace and mercy are real. I've known grace and mercy in my own life, and I'm extending it to you. And I said, Mr. President, you should have taken me by the lapels and tossed me onto Pennsylvania Avenue for what I did. I said, I am so sorry. And he said, I'll say a third time. Forgiveness, grace, and mercy are real. I'm extending it to you. I've known it in my own life. And we can talk about all of this, or we can talk about the last 8 years. Now, by this moment, it was all very surreal. And I turned around to go sit on the couch, one of the two couches. And he said, no, 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 come over here. And he asked me to sit in the place of honor where the vice president or a visiting dignitary sits, below the famous portrait of George Washington. We spoke about the last 8 years, two hard-fought campaigns for the presidency. By that time, I had been one of his longest-serving aides. We prayed together, and I recount in the book, looking around the Oval Office and feeling a kind of melancholy that I had never felt. It was all surreal what had just happened, but I really felt, as the grandson of an immigrant, that I had really let my grandfather down, because only in the United States, within a generation or two, could you rise to a position like I had. And I knew that that was the last time I would see the president or the Oval Office, and et cetera. And as I was leaving, he turned to me and said, and by the way, I want you to bring your wife and children here so I can tell them what a great father and husband you've been. And by this point, I was truly stunned. And sure enough, in a few days, my wife and boys came back. And I've seen the president several times since. I consider us to be friends. He wrote me a wonderful note about the book. And I have to say, this is elementally who George W. Bush is. And again, in things that are very personal like this, but in very large things, which I write about in the book, it all stems from his faith.
Hmm. First of all, we know that everyone sins every day. And as believers, we're supposed to be aware of that, and we're supposed to be aware of grace. And obviously, very few people sin and then have it become public and have it end up in the papers and have it. But the fact is, we're all sinners. But many people could say, oh, you know, Tim, all this talk about grace, I mean, you're a Christian, you should understand grace, you should know that. But to have grace given in such a public and shaming and whatever you want to call it forum is probably life-changing. And I want to just know from you, Tim, how did your faith change after that series of events? You just talked about being so overwhelmed by the fact that, you know, your wife and your sons are like, of course, we forgive you. Now let's go, you know, and of course, all the way up to the president and the many others, friends who called you and said, I'm behind you. I want to pray for you. How did your faith change, or how has it changed since then?
Redemption, I learned, is a process. Forgiveness is a process. Grace and mercy are real. They're as real as the fact that we're sitting in a radio studio recording this interview. But I really do believe that though forgiveness and grace and mercy are real, that repentance is the heart of it. It's not just an acknowledgement that what I did was deceptive and wrong, but it was a sense of repentance, which then takes you forward. You know, one of the things that I did not recount in the book, and in retrospect, maybe could have and should have, is a moment that I had with my pastor where we actually go into the sanctuary of our church and where I knelt down on the altar and had a sense of confession and real absolving of what I had done. And it's when you internalize your sin that you're really most horrified by what you've done. You know, there are people listening, Lisa, who have had crises in their life. Some crises are the kind where a tornado hits your house or things that are fully beyond your control. In my instance, it was my own sin and bad actions, you know? So the thing that I have learned and really learned is that forgiveness and redemption are real, but they can't be given and appreciated in a sort of snapshot moment of time. It takes time. And that's an important part of the Christian life, to move forward and to move in a different direction.
Hmm. All right, last question. You have met and are, but you've met throughout your life extraordinary people. We've talked about some of them, senators, congressmen, the president of the United States, several other presidents, Ronald Reagan, you met him. We didn't even talk about that. Bill Buckley, people that you call friends who we see on the TV. What makes a person extraordinary?
Humility. Hmm. My favorite poet is T.S. Eliot, who I consider to be the greatest poet of the 20th century. He famously wrote what I consider to be the three most beautiful words in the English language. He said, humility is endless. And I believe that's true. I begin The Man in the Middle with a verse from Proverbs 11 that essentially says that pride does go before a fall. And I twin that with a very beautiful quote from one of my favorite writers, G.K. Chesterton. Among many of the things, he wrote a series of novels called The Father Brown Mysteries. And Chesterton says, you know, the temptation is to think that when you're at the height of the mountain, that then you're really seeing the best view. That's pride. He said it's the opposite. He said it's when you're in the valley that you have the greatest vista. You know, being here in Colorado Springs, and especially, you know, coming from Washington, you know, I never fail to be dazzled by the magnificence and the luminosity of the Front Range of the Rocky Mountains and the and Pikes Peak. And I think that that's what Chesterton meant. And so in my view, if you want to really understand greatness in any human being, whether they're really famous or they're not a person who will be, you know, perhaps remembered much beyond their lifetime, the one common narrative that I have found is this real spirit of genuine humility, because I think it is the heart of Jesus Christ.
And that it is, and very difficult to find and to express and to see expressed, and especially, you know, when pressed or in difficult times. So, all right. Tim Gagline, a friend to us, certainly here at Focus on the Family, a friend to me since I've met him now several times, and author of The Man in the Middle, the book that we've been talking about, but also just a great co-worker here at Focus on the Family and the many things that you're doing out there in D.C. and beyond as you travel to and fro. And we're always privileged when you can pop by the Boundless Studios and chat with us for a bit. So,
well, I appreciate that very much. And it gives me the opportunity to say what I really believe, which is I have been a fan of Boundless for many, many years. And I have, because of the book, done many interviews by now. And I can say without exception that once again, this is one of the truly one of the most thoughtful, engaging interviews that that I've done, and it's because you have a conversational style. I think that is so appealing to other people. I feel like I've been sitting in my coffee room.
Well,
you know?
I know.
So thank you so much.
And we're missing some coffee and some snacks. We should have provided those. Right. But well, this is great. And I mean, it's so true, Tim. How we our audience loves to see and hear from people who are real. And we're so looking, I mean, especially the 20-somethings today are looking for people that will inspire them and motivate them and give them hope that really there is something beyond themselves. And obviously, we push the Lord here on the show 24/7 and who he is and what he can do in our lives. But it's great to see people who have taken that on as well.
I know we're supposed to conclude the interview, but let me just say in the last couple of seconds, not only do I completely agree with what you've just said, but it's why I've chosen to close the book in a chapter that's titled The Coming American Renaissance, mm-hmm. The Coming Rebirth of America. I do believe that because I think faith in politics, faith in public life, we're a religious republic, to quote Michael Novak. We're a religious republic, and I believe that the Judeo-Christian tradition, though obscured right now, is alive and well. And I believe that in the boundless generation, good things will come about. I do believe that.
All right. Well, check out the book, everyone. Again, The Man in the Middle, Practice Patriotism and Practice Repentance. Two lessons definitely learned within this interview. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks so much.
Well, hello, everyone. We are opening up this week's inbox as we close out the show, and I have John Thomas with me. John, welcome.
Thanks, Lisa. Hey.
Hey. Good to hear your voice and not just see your pen on the page. We always love having you. Well, we've got a brief question this week for you, but one that is really loaded, and so hopefully you're going to be able to infuse some wisdom and hope for this person. I am hoping. I mean, when I read this, I was like, hopefully this person is just kind of asking this rhetorically, but it sounds like they're really discouraged. So
okay,
let's see what you have to say.
Okay.
They say, I have had trouble finding even the smallest of jobs for my entire adult life. I've tried my best in school and always made a lot of effort to be diligent, but despite this, it seems that I have no place where I can make the world a better place. Do you think that my mission on earth is to do nothing? Has God really created me to be useless?
Well, I think this is probably written at a pretty down moment, and I think we all kind of struggle with that at different times in valleys that we're going through. I wonder, first of all, how long they're considering the search being their entire adult life. If this is someone who is 50. Then I might consider this maybe a little bit more serious than someone who has just been out of college for a few months or even a year or more. But I do have some thoughts. I hope to maybe offer a little encouragement. Obviously, no, God has not created you nor anyone to be useless. We all have been made for a fulfilling calling or vocation or ministry or life, whatever you want to call it. But here's what I want this person to understand, and anybody who kind of has struggled with this at different times, having trouble finding a job does not equate to being created by God to be useless. We all go through those times. We all have times when we maybe can't find work or doesn't feel right about the season of life that we're in. The first thing that happens to us, those of us who are believers, is it seems like as we go immediately to the character of God and we bring that into question. And I think that's something that the enemy uses. I haven't found a job and therefore God is not who he says he is. He made a mistake in creating me and somehow I slipped through God's grand design as a mistake. So here's what I suggest to this writer and to anybody who kind of is facing something like this, let's change the conversation. Let's start with who God is and who he says he is. And so instead of looking at the circumstances and saying, well, God forgot about me and created me as useless, let's start with what we know is true about God. God, you say, I am your beloved child. You said that you're my friend. You said that you haven't left me alone, that you love me perfectly, that there never has been nor ever will be anyone who is more kind to me and more decent to me and more supportive of me and more helpful to me than you are. So start there. God, you have a perfect plan for me. God said all of these things about himself and about me and a lot more. So that settles the God question about who he is and what his plans are for me. And there's lots of scriptures that we could reference there. So this isn't a question about his character or his love for me. So this becomes more of an adventure of discovery on what it is he made for me. Did he make me for something? Yes. So what is it? So we start that process of the journey. So we keep turning over rocks, and we keep looking, and we keep asking God for guidance. And we learn to hear his voice, and we, in the meantime, strive for 100% obedience and repenting when we fail and get up and move on to the next thing. And then we take another step, and then we pray, and then we listen, and we take a step of faith. And it's a rhythm that we get ourselves into with him and try to then take these steps of faith in the way that he's leading us. So I wrote about this a bit ago, and I want to remind listeners of this again. I was in my late 20s. I had a bachelor's degree. I was engaged, and I had years of work experience, and I was without a job. And I could not find a good, fulfilling job. And so I was doing childcare for my niece. I was cleaning homes for my brothers and sisters. And that was humbling, and that was difficult. But I was trying to be faithful in the little opportunities and the little things that God provided for me in the waiting. And so I want to encourage this person to A, think differently about who God is, and B, take what's offered and be faithful in that little thing, and trust God who sees a much larger picture than you can see about your life. So really, finding work is not that hard. Finding work that we want to do and we enjoy doing is a little bit harder. So let's be faithful in the stuff that maybe doesn't bring all the quite, you know, excitement that we hoped it would, and trust God that he's doing something bigger than we can see in that, and understand that absolutely God has made you for his purposes. Now we just got to find out what it is.
Sure. Great. Well, good thoughts there. I think too, if this person, I just tend to think that if this person is a millennial, they can easily fall prey to that kind of the curse that has come upon millennials, that there has to be this amazing calling or amazing mission. And if you're not in that by the time you're 21, then you've gotten off track, you know. And we see so many that are looking to get involved, whether it's in missions or in some kind of social justice pursuit or something. And if it's not, you know, they can't just go to an 8-to-5 job. And if they do, you know, what's wrong with them? And I think God can grow us through that and really understand that there are many ways that we could serve him in many different places.
In fact, Lisa, it's almost a necessity. If you look at the people in Scripture, if you look at the ones that God, you know, used for this and that, whatever they were, virtually all of them have to experience the season of training and getting to know who God is and what he's about and what he's like. Mm-hmm. You see that with Moses. You see that with David. You see that with Saul, who became Paul. You know, these extended seasons of what must have felt very pointless.
Yeah.
And yet God was at work in all of that to do something in their heart that prepared them for the thing. So,
right.
You know, it's only in the last few seconds of history that we think we ought to get that when we're 21.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Joseph was in prison. So
Joseph,
until
yeah.
someone
I mean,
sits...
you look at Joseph's preparation, right. It really was not fun at all.
Yeah. So until you sit in prison for 2 years, which may be the job you're currently in, I felt I had a few jobs that I felt were similar to that experience.
Bottom of a well.
Right.
How many jobs like that have I had?
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you so much, John, for weighing in on this one.
My pleasure.
Very, very good. So folks, write to us at editor@boundless.org so we can answer your question in the future and certainly hopefully give you some hope for the situation that you are in. That is it for this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.